Welcome to the Cognac Expert Calendar podcast, hosted by Taylor.
So today I'm very happy to be speaking with Guilhem Grosperrin from Cognac Grosperrin. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you, Taylor. Nice to speaking with you.
Same. It's great to speak with you. So for our listeners who may not know, can you tell us who you are and what you do at Cognac Grosperrin?
Okay, so I'm Guilhem Grosperrin. I'm the general director of the small cognac house, Grosperrin, and also the master cellar of the house. About 20 years now, I started working with my father around 2000, 2001, in 2000, in 2003, in 2004. And since that date, I set myself the goal to create a cognac house, how it used to be, with the roots of a négociant from the 19th century. And that's my passion, that's what I live for.
Okay. And if you don't mind me asking, how old were you when you started the business?
I was very young at the time. The official onboarding, I remember, was on the 6th of August, 2004. I was already working a little bit before that, but the 6th of August, 2004 was the date of my birthday, and I had just turned 24.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Very young. And what are some of the things you've learned over the years from then until now? I know that's a very big question.
Yes, it's fascinating. Well, what I learned first, I learned a lot about myself first. For learning anything about cognac, of course, but the first point is to how to evolve, how to develop a cognac house in context, which in 2004 was an extremely difficult context with the crisis that was there. How to fight it? It was, I think, because I was very young at that time. I did not ask myself the questions. I just pushed as much as I could, because, you know, when you're young, you can push. And so I don't know if I would have done, I don't know if I would have had the same energy today to do that. I don't think so. So thanks to that, I learned about myself a lot first. After that, of course, a lot about cognac. I learned everything because I worked with my father. I was in the spirits industry and, of course, in cognac. Naturally, from an early age, you learn a lot. So for me, it was very natural and my universe at the time. But I didn't know I had a lot of beliefs that came from what I was hearing at home. Sometimes anger from my father, or a situation that he mentioned at the table when we were all eating together. And all those moments, I had an idea about it. I was young, but with me, I realized that a lot was also wrong. And a lot of the things I thought were wrong, well, I learned that on my own time, and it's also part of learning, you know? It's dismantling little by little the things we imagine that we believe, and then to rebuild others, which may also be bought to be dismantled later. So I mostly learned that there was nothing, not everything was all black or all white. And, for example, that big houses are not the devil. They're actually far from that. That small houses are not the absolute value givers. They're also far from that, too, in my opinion. That is, the reality is a mixed box. Also, that all viticulteurs, even a small one, are not necessarily people with whom I always had things going on. And cognac has a direct relationship with humans. So since we're getting into family stories, we're getting closer to what's going on in families. So it's human relationships that are the most important. And I learned a lot from that. And I'm still learning every day today.
Voilà. Okay. And you said at the beginning that you're a négociant éleveur. And I emphasize the word éleveur. Can you explain exactly what a négociant éleveur is and what kind of work it consists of?
about the négociant, there are two dimensions to that. There's the négociant and the éleveur. The négociant is a person who does not produce their own eau-de-vie. It's one who will buy. You can also call him a merchant. A négociant is so basically a merchant. It is one who will have one who produces, who will negotiate, and he will negotiate the price for him to buy the eau-de-vie. And then it's his objection. There are négociants who want to buy the cheapest possible and resell the most expensive possible. Those are roughly explained négociants without own stock. The objective is to push the market, buying and selling, buying and reselling. Something that is fundamentally important in that business. It must be on everyone's mind. Négociants are very formidable, as you wouldn't refer to them as perhaps you could have been referring to dealing makers. And I like this term. And basically, négociant, that word already says how it is, what he does, buying, reselling, buying and selling. And it says how the things are. And éleveur is an additional dimension. The term éleveur comes rather from the wine business, by the way. I used it for the first time about 15 years ago because there was no term at the time to define the job of an éleveur. We didn't use that term in cognac, and it took back 20 years ago when I heard it for the very first time again. I started to communicate on it to say the négociant who carries his stock, that is to say the one who takes the risk of buying, to go see the bank, to make a pre-bank, to carry the eau-de-vie. This one has a completely different link with his eau-de-vie than the négociant. Because the goal here is to make bets, if you want so. The éleveur makes bets on the lot, meaning that with his eau-de-vie, he thinks it's good, maybe also very good, and that tomorrow it will sell for more money, and it's going to be more valuable. He has a long-term vision. And it's a little bit to compare with a cheesemaker. Let's say who's going to buy a cheese and who's going to keep it because it's going to sell it more expensive when it's a little older, more scented. Well, the négociant éleveur, that's exactly that. It's one who's going to preserve his eau-de-vie. He's going to make them age and improve them over time. So he takes more risk because he's also storing it and taking care of it. He has to organize the whole procedures and structures around it. And that's what his company is all about. So those two are not the same jobs. And besides, it requires very different infrastructures since the négociant marchand basically just needs a few assistants and he will outsource, in fact, the bottling, he will outsource a lot of other things. While the négociant éleveur, he needs to have his own chais, his own cellar, his whole infrastructure that belongs to him to be able to improve his stocks. So it's not the same type of business. However, you can also have from time to time a merchant because at the end, however, the négociant éleveur also sometimes can become the merchant because not every time it's enough to rely on the bank that they give you some money or that you can invest. So sometimes if you need some turnaround, quick turnaround, that person also becomes a merchant.
Okay, perfect. Good explanation. Very clear. Okay. So if we move to the cognac that we're tasting today, what cognac is this? And can you say some words about this?
About this one, because I'm a bit of a wholesaler in this business regarding that cognac. This cognac comes from the terroir of the Bonbois, which was introduced to me about a year and a half ago by a friend, actually a co-worker who worked for a long time in a big cognac house who had a friend, and he left. He had a friend who owned a small vineyard in Bonbois in Sarnon, a few kilometers from Sarthe, and he told me that his friend whose dad passed away or has just died or inherited old cognacs from the crew of Bonbois. And well, so he has no vocation. He had no vocation to keep that. He had to sell it. He also had two brothers who were not in the cognac business, and those two brothers, well, they needed a little bit of money. They would like to see the stock sold and inherit what his father had, share it and in three. And yeah, so those were the three brothers. And well, I told them and I asked them, listen, give me some samples. There was no problem for me to get the samples. Apparently, the father who died was really sick for a long time. And in fact, he hadn't touched the eau de vie for a very long time, so the barrels have never been filled. It was a really big mess. I had to redo the complete inventory with my friend, and he bought me an Excel sheet with a list of everything that was in stock in the cellar, and then a sample of each. Then I tasted them, and I found they were pretty good. So I told him, there are about 20 barrels of eau de vie that I found all good. If the price is correct, I'm going to buy them. So I made him a price proposal for the whole set of the barrels, and then the three brothers talked about it among themselves. So my friend went sometime later, go and see them. They spoke to each other, they deliberated, and then they made a decision to sell them to me. So then I started from there. I wrote a paper and I wanted to have the signature of all three brothers, because in the case of inheritance, you know, it's absolutely necessary that everyone agrees, because otherwise it poses a problem. And so once I had the signature of the three brothers, I organized the removal of the barrels of the eau de vie to my property in Saint-Ange, in Saintes. And then I actually realized why those eau de vie were so low in alcohol. In fact, it was because the house was a very small cellar where the barrels were stocked in. The cellar was on beaten ground, so with a lot of dirt on the ground and fairly humid environment. This caused that the eau de vie dropped a lot in degree, and that's naturally. But there's never been water in it, so it just dropped its ABV naturally. For this cognac, we're talking that it's about 50 years, and the chèvre was very small. And back time, and back then, it's really important to know that in the 70s, in being more precise, in 73 and 70, there were not. Why was the cellar so small? Because years like 73 and 70 were really big years. And for smaller producers, they didn't have a lot of space, so they had to put everything in one barrel. So he saw himself forced to mix some eau de vie from different years. So 70, 73, and 74 were really big years, so a lot of producers mixed those years together, which is also the case for this one here. Another fact why it was important to mix the 74 in there as well was because those previous eau de vie, they were below 40% ABV, and with adding the eau de vie from 74 to the barrel, it would be up at 40% again.
So you got all 20 of the barrels, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you make a selection for this particular bottling, or is it all blended into one batch?
No, you have different barrels from different years. So not to confuse it, that was just one lot. And why did I choose this one? I found this one very good, very gourmand. It touches me personally to taste a bon bois eau de vie that's that old with that taste. Because a lot of bon bois cognac and eau de vie are not as well aged as this one here. Because a lot of bon bois are not really made to be kept for a very long time. And saying that 50 years for a bon bois is enormous. The majority of the bon bois are very younger than this one, much younger than this one. And there's another reason for this, because the viticulture of the bon bois are much smaller than those, for example, for the Grand Champagne. So the economic structure is more towards the polyculture. They most likely will also have cereals, cattle, their vineyards, of course. So that's that. And they don't consider themselves as viticulteurs. They are rather farmers in their own eyes. So keeping stocks isn't really their main motivation, because it's really expensive. Every year you have to stock them. For them, the most important is to produce wine, produce cognac, produce cereal, produce anything that comes from the cattle. And that's why having old Bonbois is very rare. And when I found this very old Bonbois, I was very happy because it was so aromatic, so gourmand, so good to drink with this ABV. And that without any sugar, without any water, without adding caramel, without wood or boisé, without anything at all. So just very natural. So we put it in a bottle because it was just beautiful.
Yeah, that's very surprising because I didn't ask you the question before, but I expected there to be a small reduction, but there's not. Wow.
No, so there's absolutely no reduction. It was a very humid cellar that made this eau de vie like that. And it's that what gives it its little particular side. I find it very charming because I'm very much used to very particular eau de vie, just like this one. And once you like an eau de vie or a cognac like this one, it's very hard to find something better and to drink something else.
Of course. Just to change the subject a tiny bit, you said that old Bonbois are really very rare. Can you, if you have the numbers in your head, can you give an idea to our listeners about old Bonbois stock in the region today versus old Grand Champagne stock in the region today?
Oui.
Absolutely. So on the global stock of the region, you should know that we have stocks today that are very high. The stock that Bouilleurs de Cru of the Grand Champagne today have on the 30th of June 2023, to that date, they have more than over 10 years worth of stock. That rises to 54,573 hectoliters of pure alcohol. For Bois Ordinaire, they are at 947 hectoliters of pure alcohol, so that's about 54 times or 55 times less. And on Bonbois, they are at 18,900. For Farmbois, it's 40,407. And for Petit Champagne, it's 39,779. And for the Borderie, they're around 8,000. But the Borderie is much smaller. So when we talk about rare stock, an aged cognac, which is rare, we especially talk about Bois Ordinaire from far, far away. So it's the Borderie, then the Bonbois, in this order.
And that's just 10 years and above. So it's probably impossible to get the number for 40 and 50 and 60 year old.
So yes, of course, for Borderie, it's even worse. Bois Ordinaire, even worse, because Bois Ordinaire, it's impossible to find something that's 20 years old. Impossible. For Borderie of 40 years, we do find some. But Bonbois over 40 years, it's also the same. It's very hard to find. A little less difficult than Borderie, but still very hard.
So coming back to this cognac, you said it comes from Bonbois, not far from Saintes. Maybe a difficult question, but are there big differences from, say, your Bonbois, the 25-year that was from down near Chalais, and the Bonbois that are more the northern part of the region?
So yes, it's not at all the same terroir. Chalet, it's more towards the south of the department. We find a lot of sand there. The Bois Ordinaire is very representable or is represented by very sandy ground. You find very beautiful eau de vie over there. In Saint-Jean-Louis-de-Saint-Ange, we are on limestone. On clay. So we can say that we're a little bit in the Fambois cru, the Fambois terroir, but a little fattier, if we can say that, a little bit heavier than the Fambois. I wouldn't necessarily say that one is better than the other, but they are slightly different to each other.
Mais un peu plus gras, voilà. Un peu plus gras, un peu plus.
un peu plus lourd, quoi. Voilà, c'est un peu moins sain que les fins bois. Ça fait des vins un peu plus chauds en alcool, et quand on les distille, eh ben, ça fait des eaux de vie plus riches. Plus riches, quoi, voilà. Donc, c'est un terroir. Il y a pas, je dirais, l'un n'est pas meilleur que l'autre, hein, c'est juste des terroirs légèrement différents.
Yeah, okay. Now, getting back to this small producer, if we can call it that, do you know anything about the size of the alambic?
Oh, unfortunately, I don't remember, but I do know that it was small. But seeing that it was a property of less than 10 hectares, it was a small one. But I don't remember anymore. But 50 years ago, the eau de vie were distilled in alambic that were in general 6 to 7 hectoliters, maybe less even sometimes. The négociant back then, they asked for bon bois eau de vie that was more straight. Something that was not really showing the terroir. So a lot of them distilled to rectify and get those flavors out. So the alambic back then were a little bit different. We don't find any more today, but they were slightly different because of that. And also 50 years ago, it was really hard to find people that were equipped with gas, unless you were in the Grand Champagne. So in rural areas, it was still with coal and wood. Fired alambic. The brûlis were done on the wood, with the wood, and the rest on coal.
And so you said the cellar was very, very humid with a humid dirt floor. What can you say about the barrels that these aged in? Because if it's a small producer from Bonbois, I suppose this saw very little or no new oak at all.
So I'm not very capable of saying if there was any new wood at the beginning. But there were cognac barrels. They were not wine barrels. That was recorded very well. There were big barrels, therefore there was a little bit of all kind of formats. There was nothing there was nothing very in particular to point out. It was a traditional cellar, stuck up all the barrels correctly, nothing really to point out. And there were neither barrels that were transport barrels, so those are barrels that are not dedicated to stay or to age an eau de vie for a very long time, so just basic cognac barrels.
And so for this Bonbois 70/74, how many bottles of it are you going to do for this bottling? And so if we move to a tasting note, I know tasting notes are sort of subjective and personal, but how would you describe the nose and the different flavors and textures of this cognac?
So 494 bottles were bottled.
Yep. Okay.
So it has a very discreet nose with a not so powerful taste. This one is linked to the cru of the eau de vie. It has a slight bitter side that is very particular for this one. Then we also have some notes that are going to be on the woody side, which clearly testify that it's an eau de vie from an all and damp cellar. This one has not this soap taste, which often appears when there was a big reduction made on the eau de vie. It has a slight taste of this wood that you find by the beach, that you pick up from the ground, from the sand, when you're by the ocean. And then when you have it in the mouth, on the palate, I really like this attack that it has. It's a little fragile, delicate, and at the same time very present, this eau de vie, which is also very particular for eau de vie that are aged in humid cellars. It kind of reminds me of an older lady, which is a little bit fragile, who's flimsy. And then when you have the eau de vie in the mouth, it's all of a sudden something that you want to come back to, something that's lively, that's meaning that if you take one glass, you straight after want to get a second one. And I really like those kind of eau de vie that make you want to drink more. And then in terms of aromas, well, I personally, there's something that bothers me. It's this little bit of fruit side. It's something that bothers me, but also interests me. It's really weird, but I like to come back to it just because of that. It also reminds me a lot of, how do you say, wax that's left in the corner of a kitchen, which gives it a little bit of a putrid note, but or also maybe a little bit of dirty water. And on the other side, it's not very strong, so there's very interesting fruity notes as well that are typical for bon bois. Then we have some gourmandise with dried fruits. Then we have a whole traditional range of aromas for cognacs for about 50 years of age. So fruits, and we finish with the spices, something sweet like cardamom, things like that. But what excites me most about this eau de vie, about this particular cognac, is that side that is very different to most of the other cognacs, which I just said about the, I don't want to say impurity, but maybe that's in that direction that I want to phrase it.
Yeah, when I remember smelling it and tasting it, yes, the fruit stood out. I also kept picking up something sort of exotic, like some kind of a shaved coconut or something, but it's very, very unusual for me. And and then you say these putrid notes. I guess I would just classify that as a rancio. I don't like that word. It's an impossible word to define. But would you say that this has a strong note of rancio?
Yes, so rancio is very hard to describe. It's something like Loch Ness. Everyone speaks about it. No one's ever seen it. Yes, but we can call it a rancio notes. It's something that's oxidating, those kind of aromas and notes. Something very old. So it's a mix of the barrel that went together with the molecules of the alcohol. And one with the other make eau de vie that are very complete, very deep, very melted. And that's the effect of the rancio. But this kind of rancio for this cognac, it's not very much on the balsamic vinegar kind of side. It's more on the tarte tatin of old butter, old pastry, that kind of rancio. It's clearly less noble, than with some old grand champagne cognac. But he's very charming.
Sur des notes de vieux beurre, de vieilles pâtisseries, c'est un autre type de rancio. Il est moins noble, hein, clairement, que certaines vieilles grandes champagnes, mais il est vachement charmant, quoi.
It's very, very interesting. So, last question. So, obviously, you taste tons of samples from all cru, from all different ages. What today excites you in a cognac that you are tasting for the first time? If I ask the question differently, like what is something where you say, wow, this is fascinating, I love this?
Well, it's the rancio. It's that easy. But it's a certain type of rancio. For me, a very beautiful eau de vie has to be fresh. And it has to be something fruity, slightly sweet, and has a lot of elegance. Voilà, that's what makes me say, wow. And on the other hand, this description that I just gave does not really describe this bon bois that we are tasting here. But it is also something for me that I say, wow, because it's very rare, and it's something that I am not used to see or to taste. So I have different kind of emotions when I taste an eau de vie. Either it's a very nice eau de vie, a very rare eau de vie. And for example, when I taste an old grand champagne eau de vie, for me it's very hard to have this wow effect because for the quantity there is on the market, there's not many that I say wow to. And for me, there's nothing worse than an average grand champagne cognac. And when you taste a very old bois ordinaire or bon bois or very rare borderie that I'm not used to see or drink, then I say, wow, that's something rare, that's something collectible. I'm very happy to find this. Even if on the quality side of things, I know that I could find better, but the rareness, the rarity of the eau de vie, that gives me goosebumps, that says wow and fascinates me.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes the faults are charming and make the cognac or whatever the spirit is more attractive to us. Well, Guillaume, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for answering my questions. I think this is a really fascinating, interesting cognac. And I think that its alcohol degree makes it accessible to lots of different people. Sure, it is a unique cognac and you need to be ready for that. But it really is fantastic and a fascinating cognac. So, thank you again for your time. We look forward to this this Bon Bois being released, and okay. I know a lot of people are going to really enjoy this.
Thank you so much, Taylor. Okay, super. Thank you so much to you, and thanks to everyone. Enjoy the tasting, and please, when you taste this cognac, have in mind the different cru and the different stories of the families, where this eau de vie comes from, and what this eau de vie tells us. I find this very good. Voilà, happy tasting, everyone.
Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you for listening to the Cognac Expert Calendar podcast. Tomorrow is another day, another cognac.